Our presenter this morning, Phil Cousineau, is a travel leader, a freelance writer, documentary filmmaker, and author of 35 books, and we will have some of his books for sale over here following his presentation. Phil has over 20 documentary film credits, which have won more than 35 international awards. And he's been featured on numerous TV and radio shows. And since 2009, he's been host of Global Spirit on PBS and Link TV and a guest host on New Dimensions Radio. In 1999, he and his film partner, Gary Rhine, organized a group of 10 Native American leaders to accompany the late Dr. Houston Smith to the Parliament of World Religions in Cape Town, South Africa. And so his presentation today will discuss the conversations from the Parliament, and also he has film clips from their award-winning documentary, as well as other insights gathered from his decades of work with Houston Smith. So Phil was kind enough to come here today as sort of a tribute to Houston, who spoke here at our Personal Theology series many times in the past. So the title of his talk today is A Seat at the Table, Struggling for American Indian Religious Freedom. So let's give a very warm welcome to Phil Cousineau.
I just want to thank everybody for coming this morning. And thank you, Barbara, for the invitation. And thank you, Kendra, for recommending me. It's great to be back in Berkeley. It's where I spent the first 7 years after I traveled around the world after graduating from the University of Detroit in journalism. So it's nice to be back. When Barbara asked me to come and speak and mention Kendra and Houston, I had an immediate flash. I knew what I wanted to talk about: American Indian issues and Houston. There we go. We're back on. I was immediately back in Malibu in 1999 in the editing room with my film partner, Gary Rhine. We had already done 4 films on American Indian issues, and we were celebrating that this was going to be the last one. Gary was going to go out and do some features with his wife, Irene, and I was going to go on to do some other films and some TV and so on. And as we were sitting around the editing table, Gary's mail actually came in. And as we were talking and looking at footage and thinking about soundtrack and so on, he dramatically opened up the letter, and it was an invitation from the Parliament of World Religions for us to come for the 1999 event in Cape Town, South Africa. And Gary, I remember, had this little smile crossing his face, and both of us were thinking, all right, one more adventure. But rather than show one of the films which we had done, which included Wiping the Tears of Seven Generations, it was a film about the 1991, I believe, walk through the winter snows that reenacted the Bigfoot ride after the Custer massacre in the 1890s, to show that there was a way for tribal people to deal with trauma. And the image that they had was there are ways to wipe the tears away. You reenact the trauma, that way you can let it go. So that film did quite well. And then we did a film on the 1991 Smith decision, and I mean Al Smith from Oregon, not Houston Smith, which forbade American Indians to practice their native religion. And Gary and I met with some people down in Santa Fe with Houston. We all flew down there together, and we told him what we might do. It was an invitation, what we might do in response to this really heinous Supreme Court decision that forbade American Indians to practice some of their native religions. They had a budget of $250, and they said, we think you guys could make this film, right? $250. Fortunately, we had the heir to, I think it was the Smyrna vodka fortune in the room, and he so much loved Wiping the Tears of Seven Generations and our presentation, Houston, Gary, and myself, that he just said, write up a budget, I'm in. This never happens in my world. It was startling. We gave him a budget, and he produced the film, And when we finished, Gary, I have to give him credit for this, we knew we had to get the film to Washington to show Congress. But does anybody in Congress have 64 minutes to watch a film, even on an important decision like this? So we had a 30-minute version and a 6-minute version for those who only had time for a cup of coffee. This was ingenious. So we sent Houston to Washington with our film. I think Gary may have gone as well. And by the end of a few days, everyone in Congress had watched our film, basically about restoring American Indian rights to their own religious practices. And together, Houston's work and our film, we overturned the Supreme Court. Yeah. Thank you. And that means I have a bill on my wall to this day signed by Tip O'Neill and Bill Clinton assuring American Indians the right to practice their own religion. So Gary and I were flush with some success about that. We went on to do another film that is still being used on the 500 different reservations, 500 tribes, 500 peoples, always with the plural, around the country, the Red Road to Sobriety. Because, as you probably know, alcoholism runs rampant on American Indian reservations, but traditional AA does not tend to work for our own tribal people. So it turns out they have their own way of dealing with a scourge like alcoholism, and it's called the Red Road. The Black Road, just this is what, generally speaking, in American Indian theology, refers to the road of selfishness, the road of thinking only about yourself rather than your brother, your sister, other people in the tribe, elders and children and so on. But the Red Road, which is an echo of the soil itself, the Red Road refers to the spiritual road. So we did this 90-minute film on American Indians taking back their own practices, like sweat lodges, sometimes a peyote ceremony, a number of different ones, in order for them to take control of their own alcohol problem. And that film was still being used, I'm really happy to say, all around the country. And then we did a film called Your Humble Serpent, which was our friend, the nickname for our friend Reuben Snake. He was a Winnebago, what they call spiritual leader or road man. And Houston called him the American Indian Dalai Lama. I thought that was a great hook. And boy, did Reuben swagger when he got that hook on him, the American Indian. So we did this film about Reuben called Your Humble Serpent. So we did four films. And one thing I want to make very clear from the outset as you're looking at one of our images from A Seat at the Table is that, again, I have to credit Gary with this. We did something very unusual, and it's still rarely done today. Generally, if you interview people, you don't let them look at the rushes. You don't let them go in and say, I look better this way than that way. Or, I didn't mean that. Could we have a whole nother interview? I didn't mean what I said on film. It's the Pandora's box. If you begin to show people the footage, they rarely like what they said. They want another half. Anyway, it's a can of worms. But in regards to American Indian, our own indigenous people situation, we turn that upside down. So being the screenwriter, when I came up with a script for any of these films, including what you're about to see here, A Seat at the Table, we would show my first draft of a script to the elders of every tribe that we interviewed. This is rarely done. I'd say, this is what we would like to explore. Is there anything that we should tread softly on? Is there anything you don't want us to say or see? And only after we had that vetted would then we go forward with the actual interviews. This is uncanny. And we were respected greatly because we bothered. The first draft of the first cut, what they call the rough cut of the film, we would, Gary and I, and Houston on a couple of occasions, we would fly the film to the elders and we would show them the rough cut. Is there something we should not have shown here? For instance, in this film actually, we had a shot of bark paintings for the Anishinaabe Indians in Wisconsin and Minnesota, because it was often argued, as I'll talk about in a minute, that one reason why American Indian or indigenous or primal religions were not taken seriously by traditional anthropologists, sociologists, historians, is because they didn't have a written record. And this is, as we'll explore in a few minutes. This is also why Houston did not include a study of primal people, indigenous peoples, in his first book, The Religions of Man. Because, he says, I blame my teachers, Phil. My teachers did not want me to write about indigenous people because they didn't have a historical record, no written record. We found that some tribes did. They would write things down. But it was sacred. And we had gone to a lot of trouble to find an image of bark paintings and bark where they would write some of the history in Minnesota and the Wisconsin area. But when we showed it to the elders, they said, it's too sacred. So we cut it out. Finished film, we always flashed it by the elders. So can you get a feeling for what we were trying to do here? Number one, we only did these films when we were asked. We didn't barge in. Reuben told Houston once, and I remember we got this on tape, it's not in any of the films, we should pull it for some reason, but he said, yeah, Houston, you know what we Indians, what we think of traditional Indian families, a grandpa, a grandma, mother, father, two kids, and an anthropologist. It's funny, but there's also a bit of a wound there, because for a good 100 years, so many Indian people, as they would call themselves, rarely Native American, by the way, so many Indian people would say, we feel like we're under the, you ignored us for centuries, and now we're under the microscope. So to do a film, to do a radio interview, to do a book is a very touchy thing. And Gary and I only went in along with Houston in order to, my favorite phrase is, to help people who don't have a voice to have a voice. But we never filmed anything. We never edited or showed anything that had not been allowed by the elders. Make sense? So, that's summer 99. And why Houston? So Gary and I are sitting around, and we're thinking, oh, we've done 4 films. We had another one on the way. We don't want to just go to Cape Town and show another film. And we decided right then and there, let's do a whole other film. But what we want is to take American Indian elders, leaders, spiritual leaders, political leaders down to Cape Town. And then the phrase came to me. Who knows where these things come from, but I said, let's call it America's Shadow Struggle. Wow. That meant that when we got there, and there were 7,000 people from all around the world, 1999, Cape Town, South Africa, 7,000 people, hundreds of events. Ours was the most well-attended event of any of them. And it was partially, as people kept telling us, you mean Americans are owning up to the fact they have a shadow? Good psychological language, right? Americans are admitting they have a struggle with their indigenous people. This startled thousands of people. So we went down and we invited, I'll give you a little roster here. This is the companion book that I edited through UC California Press. And so we invite Vine Deloria, Winona LaDuke, if you remember her. She ran on the Green Party ticket years ago as a vice president candidate. Walter Echohawk, who you will see in my first clip. Frank Daesh, Charlotte Black Elk, a granddaughter of the Black Elk. Douglas George, an authority on Indian languages, which are disappearing rapidly. Indigenous languages disappearing about one a day, by the way. I'm a word guy, too. I love word origins, and I found out doing my word research there are about 7,100 languages left. Over half of them only have a handful of people still speaking them, and they're mostly elders. So the rough estimate is every day a language disappears. And there are some, like our friend Doug George here, who was a student. He was Houston's first American Indian student, by the way, and a very eloquent spokesperson for having American Indian radio stations, TV stations. I just read a couple of days ago, a Toronto Maple Leaf hockey game was broadcast in the local Ontario Indian languages for the first time. So Indian people were very excited about that. And then there are a couple others, Anthony Lopez, Lenny Foster. So we did 10 people, 10 elders with Houston. And why Houston? when we were working on, I think it was the Peyote Road, at one point over at dinner, we were asking, Houston, you published this book. It's considered the classic. It's already sold 2 million copies, The Religions of Man. Why the interest in Indian people? And he said, Phil, Kendra, right? Phil, he would always get my attention like this. Phil, I'm glad you asked that question. I know a good question I've never heard it before. And with that one, then he would say, Kendra and I spent 10 years in Syracuse, and we were right in the backyard of the Onondaga Reservation. And it was there that he met people like Orrin Lyons, Douglas George, many other Indian leaders. And the phrase, and he did several different versions of it. One version is in here. Another is in one of my favorite books. I believe it's Houston's last book, In Live Rejoicing, the second volume of his memoirs, which I helped him with. And in there he said, sometimes he would talk to himself when he was upbraiding himself if he had forgotten something in a book or a lecture. He says, Houston, what's the matter with you? You've girdled the globe. I always loved that phrase. I never heard anyone else use it. You've girdled the globe. I think, what did he say? 6, 7, 10 times or something? And you've been in search for other cultures to compare other religious traditions to find out if there is a perennial tradition. Is there something that people are searching for throughout time, or from one culture to the other? You've been doing this. You've been writing about all of those. While meanwhile, right underneath your feet, there is a tradition that you never gave the time of day to. And it was our American Indian tradition, which he found was really ironic. He had girdled the globe, studying Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity and its origins, but he had ignored, to his peril, our own Indian traditions here. And so in the early 90s, he took upon himself to add a last chapter to what was The Religions of Man. He retitled it because of the first version of the Me Too movement. It says, let's update this. So we call it the world religion, so it's not just about man and so on. Added a whole new chapter about primal religions, which is another way to think about the indigenous ones, and then ended up rewriting the whole book. Because the original book goes back to about 1956 in a series of interviews that he did on public television. So he rewrote the entire book, and we knew he was our man because he was so revered, even on American Indian reservations. We bring them together in Cape Town. So we went, I think, 10 speakers in 10 days, so we had 10 different lectures. And every night, this was one of the highlights for everybody, every night while we were in Cape Town, we met with representatives of the Black Caucus, the people who were had worked with Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu, who were working on land rights issues, freedom of speech issues. Every night we went out with them to different dinners, and there were tears on both sides. It was quite extraordinary because most of the young South African Black leaders were restless. They'd only had freedom. Apartheid had just toppled over, so to speak, a few years before. And from our point of view, they had made extraordinary progress. And our American Indian friends, 10 of them, were saying, you've made more progress in 3 years than we have in 100 years. And the American, the Black leaders in South Africa had not heard this. They were so restless because there had been so much violence, and they were ready for more progress. And then at one point, one of them, I remember, told Walter Echohawk, who you will see in our first clip, that they had talked to Mandela himself about what he was reading. Anybody in the room still read? Yes. All right. Oh, I know that book. I love it when people hold up my books. Right? Thank you. Now, this brought a lot of tears in the room, because one of the inspirations, according to Ahmed Kathrada, who was one of our personal guides around Cape Town, and he was Nelson Mandela's cellmate for 17 years on Robben Island. He said one of the most inspirational tomes or books for him was Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That is what Mandela read while he was imprisoned or incarcerated. And that's when, according to now the emerging story, it's one of the things he read to gird his loins, as they used to say, to give him the courage to go on with the anti-apartheid movement there. And that was news. It was very moving for our American Indian friends to hear that. Between 1991, then, when I began working with Houston, and 2008, we finished 5 films, including this one, and at least 3 books, maybe even 4, if you count the book that he did with Ruben Snake that I worked on with him about bringing American, ensuring religious freedom for American Indians, which was a pretty good track record. And this was nostalgic for me to look at some of this footage last night to think of something that we've done that has now carried the test of time. We took this film to about 35 film festivals around the world. A tremendous interest in this, a seat at the table, which, as you will hear in this first clip, the title itself emerged out of conversation. We would, while we're bringing this back on, we'd have dinners every night before one of the public presentations. And Walter Echohawk, who's a Pawnee Indian and one of the great land rights and water rights advocates for American Indian reservations, water rights, big issue in the Northwest, for example. At one point, we were asking, and what do you want to talk about? We would ask them rather than give them an agenda, which was very welcome to our Indian friends. What's in your heart at the moment? What do you want to talk about? And Walter gave us the title of the film and then the book. He said, we have come all the way down here. He's from Oklahoma down to Cape Town, South Africa. Not because we want more rights than white people. Not because we weren't even talking about reparations and so on. He said, we want a seat at the table anytime our future is being determined. We don't want to hear about it later from someone else. Now, just one side note on that. Barbara was kind enough to mention that I've been hosting this show, co-writing or hosting this show called Global Spirit on PBS. You can look at globalspirit.com. We've done 25 shows. John Clace of Monty Python was the presenting host the first year. This last 2 years, Carlos and Cindy Santana have been the presenting hosts. And out of those 25 plus shows, we probably have 15, 16 indigenous people from Australia to Guatemala represented. And one program we shot at the United Nations, and it's called Earth Wisdom. And I interview 40 different elders from different traditions all around the world. And what was startling about this week-long presentation at the United Nations in New York was that it was the first gathering since 1945 in which indigenous peoples were, always with a plural, by the way, indigenous peoples were allowed to speak for themselves. Now, this sounds flabbergasting, right? But until this week, you'll see this all in our film. It's called Earth Wisdom. Let's say if there's a water rights issue for Australian Aborigines, it would be the white representatives from the Australian government who would go to the United Nations and discuss whatever was the issue. In Lapland, northern Finland, if there was an issue with the reindeer, the Sami people were not allowed to speak at the UN. It would have to be someone from the white government. So can you feel the severity of this? This is taking a long while. Political issues, political activists, along with literary people, film people, all gathering together to help indigenous people have their own voice. Okay? So let's go to the first clip here. This is Walter Echohawk. It's 9 minutes long. It'll take just a minute or two after this one, so you can take that in. I'll point out a couple of ideas that Houston gleaned from these 10 interviews that we did, and then I'll go to the second clip, which is Winona LaDuke. And the reason, why I want to give them the time is because, once again, we don't need one more white guy coming in to talk for American Indians, right? What I have been able to do, and I invested 20 years of my life to be invisible for these interviews, but to give time, energy to people who have not been heard. So, Walter Echohawk. This is early American Indian rap, by the way.
My understanding is that the reason that this parliament is being held in Cape Town is because this parliament wants to emphasize the issues of justice, and there is no place on this planet which so graphically brings to mind the injustice of human beings towards human beings. But as I see it, you and your colleagues in this symposium, you want to call the world's attention to something that so easily could pass unnoticed. The primal indigenous religions are generally overlooked.
I agree with you. I think that religion is a mark of humanity in all ages, in all races, in all quarters of the world. And that includes Native Americans. They are overlooked. They are unprotected in the eyes of the law. I think one reason that our delegation came here was to try to get a seat at the table.
A seat at the table. Now, as we move into this, I wonder if you would give us a general overview.
In the United States, the Native Indigenous peoples are virtually invisible. Most of your average American citizens, as well as government policymakers, know virtually nothing about Native people. Most Americans have never met a Native American, have never spoke with one. The present population are over 2 million Native people, including Alaska. There are 500 tribes in the United States that are federally recognized by the government. Most of them have reservations. These are permanent homelands that were established in treaties between tribes and the federal government, where the policy of the government was to obtain Indian lands and put them onto small reservations, which represent just a fraction of their territory. Very similar to the apartheid homeland system here in South Africa. Exercise sovereignty and jurisdiction over the land, the natural resources, the water, and the people of that territory. So that within the United States, it's not just one nation, but a nation that is composed of about 500 nations within nations.
There there's something different about indigenous religions that separate them from what in our vocabulary we call the historical religions with their written text and cumulative history. They say, you know, we can't find what there is in these religions that we can specifically tag as religious, because it just permeates the entire way of life.
Many of the tribal religions were forced to go underground in the United States during about an 80-year period when it was illegal to practice, and through those generations evolved tenets of secrecy where you cannot disclose certain sacred knowledge to non-practitioners in the religion. One could be punished or sanctioned, you know, for violating these tenets. This is a long history that leads up to the present day. It began literally on the very first day that Christopher Columbus came to the New World on October 12, 1492, when his diary literally recorded that the Indians should easily be made Christians because it seems to me they have no religion. And from that point in history to the present, there have been attitudes of religious intolerance or superiority to the effect that the proselytizing religions of Europe or the Middle East hold that they are better, and that the indigenous religions of the New World are not religions and not worthy of any form of protection as a human rights matter. And those kinds of attitudes we see today, but they become dangerous as a human rights matter when the machinery of government is invoked and used to carry out those attitudes. The world has been subject to colonialism. It's now been repudiated, but the legacy of colonialism in Africa, North and South America, Australia, most of Asia, is that the present nations of the world contain indigenous populations that were residing in those countries. 350 million people, which are 6% of our whole humanity, are nations within nations in these 72 countries. And their fate, I think, is the paramount religious question as we go into this next millennium. Will the unique religions of these indigenous peoples survive?
Thank you, Walter. A couple of points there. One, Walter's referring to Columbus's early journals. Something else we know from recent rereadings of the journals, and I get this from Peter Matheson, one of our great writers today, adventure writers, botanist. His book, The Snow Leopard, is considered one of the great travel classics. He also wrote a book simply called Indian Country, in which he spent many years going around in his pickup truck from one reservation to the other. And on the first page of Indian Country, he writes that if you look closely at the reproductions of the first entry in Columbus's journals, when he first gets off the ship and embarks on the first island, he describes the native people as INDIOS, Indios. So he said there was an old tradition that the first few days in which Columbus is trying to look at them through brand new eyes, as it were, he had never seen people that beautiful, that graceful, in that much harmony with nature. So he said they are Indios. They are as if they are walking with God. And later came this whole other interpretation that Indians It means Columbus took a wrong turn at Greenland. He thought he was going to India, and he ends up in the New World, which is a kind of bastardization of perhaps what could have been a very beautiful way of looking at all the new encounters in the New World. Indios. A second point he makes, when Huston is saying there's no place in the world that is more poignant for us to have this conference, what Huston is referring to is the actual site where the conference was being held. And it was a neighborhood that was considered the most cosmopolitan, most colorful neighborhood, with more races from all around Africa, plus European people, in any of the neighborhoods of Cape Town. And it was the first one that was bulldozed when apartheid came in, I believe 1966. And this was very symbolic for the government to go in and knock down the most popular neighborhood, the one that when they had the best music, art galleries, and so on. And it had laid empty for 33 years, so 66 to 99. This was very symbolic. We are going to bring all the world's religions together. We're going to invite 7,000, 8,000 people here, and we're going to have it in the site of our own favorite neighborhood. It was a symbolic, almost a phoenix moment. Cape Town and the New World will rise again on this very site. And then Huston's reference to, you can see he's pulling for some kind of image there because of his own background studying world religions, and there was a great condescension from other scholars. Why bother to study these people? There's no written tradition. We don't see anything. We don't see churches. We have someone named Guy Lopez later on who said, well, we never needed cathedrals because our forests are our cathedrals. So there was a poetic way for them to say it. But it meant that if we as white Anglos can't see religion, it must not exist. And one of Huston's favorite stories about this comes from the time when you were there in Syracuse, Kendra, with Huston, and he was invited by the Onondaga people to go to a morning celebration at the Longhouse, which would be where many of the ceremonies were held. And Huston felt very proud. This was his first invitation to anything American Indian, Native American. He was proud. He loved Orrin Lyons, who's still around. He tends to be, excuse me, the speaker. If anyone has to speak for the 500 tribes, for cameras and conferences, UN conferences and so on, it tends to be Orrin Lyons. So he was a heavyweight. And they have breakfast together. They meet. They have, I believe they had a smudging ceremony. And then at one point, Orrin says, Huston, it's been an honor to have you here. It's 11 a.m. and we're all walking into the Longhouse now. Everybody except you. And Huston, in his many versions of this, would say, you'd think I would feel rejected, but instead my response was exhilaration. That's Huston's word. It was exhilaration that there were still places in the world in which they had rituals and ceremonies and gatherings that were so sacred it would be profane if the wrong people witnessed it. And he's actually right on so many levels, including the linguistic one. Our word profane actually means outside or before the temple. Profanum. What's sacred is inside of the temple. Once you walk through it, across the threshold and into the church, the temple, the synagogue, the mosque, and so on, what's outside of it is profane. And Huston got it at that moment, which I thought was really wonderful. One more clip. So this is now going to be Winona LaDuc, one of our great spokespersons. She is still speaking up for ecological movements, especially on American Indian reservations, because they tend to take it on the chin, as it were, more than other people. Shall we? Okay. This is footage we shot in the townships.
One of the most rewarding visits for the delegation was to the Fulani Nutrition Center in one of the townships outside Cape Town. At the community center, local mothers gather every morning to learn about proper nutrition for their children, meet with each other to strengthen their community, and sing traditional songs. Speaking to the sacred relationship between native ceremonies and nature was Winona LaDuc of the White Earth Anishinaabe Reservation in northern Minnesota. An author and activist, Ms. LaDuc is founding director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project and program director of the Honor the Earth program.
I know that you live in northern Minnesota. Would you begin by telling us something about how you see the ecological character of the world?
I would start by saying hello, my relatives. And that is perhaps as a greeting in itself, indicative of kind of how we place ourselves
right. In
the world as Anishinaabe people. We say that it's based on our spirit, our heart, our breath, and our physical being. And all of those aspects of our way of life are reflected in our spiritual practice. In my community, we have religious practices that are perhaps considered more institutions. We have the Madewin Lodge, which is the Grand Medicine Society, and we have Chidwegan, the Big Drum Society. But these are teachings within a larger set of teachings that exist in our community, and those teachings are a way of life called Minopamatasiwin, which means basically to live a good life. And as Anishinaabe people, and perhaps as other indigenous people, that's what we're instructed to try to do. And that way of life is in recognition of all those relations which are around us and are part in that web. My community, while I'm most familiar with it, I think it's a microcosm of indigenous communities kind of on a worldwide scale where you have a cultural practice.
Right.
And your spiritual practice is integral to your cultural practice. It's not separate. In our community, for instance, we're considered a forest culture or a woodlands culture by anthropologists who like to categorize everybody according to something that makes sense to them.
Right.
So we'd be the woodlands people, you know. And what I find is in the case of being a woodlands culture is that you actually have to have a woodlands to be a woodlands culture, you know. The Creator did not place us in the prairie, and the Creator did not place us in a clear cut. The Creator placed us in a forest that was full of life. And in that forest, we find our old stories that exist that taught us how to be. We find our scrolls. You know, there's a lot of talk about our religious practices, our ceremonial practices are not recorded. We have thousands of years of records written on birch bark scrolls of our practices. So our teachings come from those forests. Our medicines come from those forests. Medicines that are used historically, and many of the things that we find that we need a new medicine for today, we find them in our forests, and that's the life that that forest gives us. So that's one of our, you know, great teachings is you care for that forest because that forest is what cares for you. I'm kind of a humble person and small in our religious and our spiritual practice. You know, I try to pray most days, but I can't explain all the, you know, but how I'm told is that they gave us the original teachings.
Right.
And they're our relatives. And all I know is that as humans, you and I, we only know a little bit. As such, we botch up. You know, every 10 generations or so, we make some big mistakes. And all our communities have these teachings, you know, that say, you know, we made those mistakes and then we are corrected. And then we're supposed to stay on our path.
Yeah.
You know, get back on our path. That's a really important concept because there's this, I would say, kind of industrial mythology that indigenous peoples want to go back. And it is not about going back. It is about being on your path that the Creator gave you, which is not a going back path.
Yeah.
It's following your instructions. And so what I'd say is, because we're human, you know, we often stray. We hope that we could correct ourselves through prayer and through our community. But, you know, sometimes it takes, you know, if you want to call it divine intervention, to correct us.
I want to come stay with your notion of not going back, because that resonates very deeply with me, because I've given my life to trying to understand the world's great religious tradition, and I get charged right down the line regularly with that I'm concerned with the past. And my retort, which I firmly believe, no, I'm not interested in past, present, and future. I'm interested in what is timeless, which is so true that it was true then, and it is true now, and it will be true in the future. So you've given me a great reinforcement and encouragement for that view of things. Do you see any hopeful signs?
The time we are in now, where cultures and industrialism causes people to unroot and causes people to be constantly moving. As a result of colonialism, you have the idea that there's a constant frontier. There's always a new place to go. There's always a new place that's going to be better. And that pushes totally against what we are as indigenous people, which says this is the place that we are, and we're okay here. At the cusp of the millennium, you know, what you find is that these indigenous communities everywhere are facing this crisis of being in an area where, you know, your sacred site, somebody wants to mine it, you know, or they want to put in, you know, log it, or they want to, you know, put in a resort or a telescope there. Or the animals that are part of your prayers, like our sturgeon, you know, they aren't in your ecosystem now. They're over in a zoo someplace.
The question is, have we reached in industrial society a point of no return?
You and I know that you've got an ecological crisis in this world that's, you know, we're kind of in a fix. And I'm worried about how thin the ozone hole is. Dow Chemical creates these things that go up into the atmosphere today and show up in the tissue and the breast milk of indigenous women all around the world. You have this crisis as a consequence, I believe, of a spiritual crisis that exists in the larger society that doesn't have a place that it calls home that it is responsible for.
There are echoes of what you have said in all of the great tradition. In my mind, the unique contribution of the indigenous people is to focus on this point of mutual relatedness and therefore mutual responsibility.
Makes a difference. We're going to talk about indigenous religion, spirituality, to actually see these people, right? There's something in the voice, there's something in the face that I can't convey. I can convey what it's like to interview them, help them find a voice, but we need to see them. That's the point of all our films, all the books that we've done together, and to try to give them some respect. So I dedicate this morning to our Native friends. One thing that you may have noticed as we opened up, and it happened with all 10 speakers, by the way, and we tried to accommodate it each way, but you notice Houston jumps right in to ask a pretty intellectual question of Winona here, and she pauses. If you notice, she leans in. She's very graceful about it. Puts her hand up, and she says, she nods to him out of great respect because they all respected Houston so much for his contribution to comparative religion, you might say. And she said, "First, I want to thank my elders." Did you notice that? Every one of our speakers did that. And the reason was because when our invitations went out, Winona, would you like to come to Cape Town? Frank Daesh, Walter Echohawk, they all went to their own elders in their tribes, and they had meetings with everyone. And they said, this is what Phil and Gary and Houston would like to do. May I represent our tribe at this conference? And sometimes it didn't work. They had to find a different speaker, but I found that to be so eloquent. And then in turn, they want to acknowledge in front of 7,000 people at this conference, I'm not here just speaking as me, Winona LaDuke, which would be very ego-driven, right? Instead, they would all bow. Their voices were always very gracious in the beginning and say, I'm here for my grandfather and grandmother, or I'm here for the elders in Wisconsin, or South Dakota, wherever they might be coming from. And then the discussion can go on from there. Imagine if we prefaced our conversations that way or our interviews. I'm speaking for my neighborhood today. I'm speaking for my city. I've found that to be very remarkable. Another thing, in one of the outtakes, I believe it's Walter who is quoting Orrin Lyons about this business, about the difference between our need or our desire to have our temples. Remember my friend Joe Campbell, who was my mentor. I did my first book and film was on Campbell, in which he described the difference between the Christian cathedral and the Greek temple. The Christian cathedral is enclosed and the attention is up. That's why you've got the vaulted ceilings. You've got the stained glass that takes your vision from here up, up, up. And the notion is to lift your chin, lift your consciousness up to the world of transcendence, another world, the spiritual world. Get away from this earth, the land. The Greek temples are always open. Many of them are situated in such a place where you could be in the middle of a religious ceremony in a Greek temple, but you're looking through the columns. You're looking outside to the world of nature. That would be the compromise between American Indian religion and ours. So Orrin said, well, I remember in the interview I did with him at the United Nations, well, Phil, yes, it's true. All for Indian people, all Indian people, every place is sacred, but some places are a little more sacred than others. And this is where you might have the ritual or the ceremony. And that's echoed with all of our 10 speakers as well. Let's see. In terms of a couple of the things that Houston writes about in the book, the companion book to our film, we have a few copies here, that he learned over his many years of working with indigenous peoples. First is a realization that the world is animated and not inanimate. And by that I mean the world has spirit. The world has soul. All indigenous people will talk about the life in animals. Remember, animal actually comes from anima. It was an early realization in Europe that animals had spirit. That's why you call them animals. They are animated. But we closed in so that only human beings had souls. And there's actually a dictate when Portugal and Spain were warring over South America, and there were reports of genocide going all the way back to the Vatican in Rome, which was upsetting Rome quite a bit. Some of this is in the movie The Mission, by the way. Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro, if you remember that magnificent film. And they were wondering, there's a lot of massacres of South American Indians happening here. This doesn't feel right. What do you think? And there was a debate in the Vatican whether or not South American Indians had souls, because if they had souls and they were being killed or slaughtered by European soldiers, that would be what? It would be genocide, right? So it was decided that American Indians in the New World had souls, but they were very little souls. It's actually there. It's in a papal bull. Orrin Lyon writes about this if you want to pursue that. So something that Houston learned being with so many American Indian different tribes, was that the world is alive and not dead. My friend Jamaka Highwater, if any of you know him, he is a Blackfoot Indian, wrote beautifully about American Indian issues. He is the one who helped us shift from using anthropological language like savages. Claude Levi-Strauss actually writes about savages when he's writing about Brazilian and Uruguayan Indians. So that has become quite offensive to many people, and rightly so. So in 1976, Jamaka began using the phrase primal, which means first. So it's a way to think about the first people that were on any land anywhere. And in his book, The Primal Mind, which became an Emmy Award-winning PBS series, it's on YouTube, by the way, now. It's actually a beautiful film. He gave me a piece of advice that has still helped me all these years later, in which he said, if you white people, you Anglos, if you're still having trouble understanding the way that we American Indians, we indigenous people, look at the world, think like an artist. I've never heard anyone think about this before. How does a great photographer, André Cartier-Bresson, look at the world? As if the world is alive. And you follow with your camera and you look for movement. You look for animated moments. Painters are looking for light and life. Poets, you can't be a poet and think that the world is dead. You can't be a poet and look at the forest, a tree, a rock, as if it's all dead. So if you want to understand how Native people think, feel, apprehend the world, put yourself in the place of an artist and vice versa, which I thought was really helpful. Two other points for that Hewson came up with as part of his kind of recap of this. When I did an interview with him, a few interviews actually, in the last weeks of his life, which became part of a book, a beautiful tribute book to Hewson, published by Fons Vitae Press in Kentucky, by the way, in which he said, I asked him, Hewson, are you apprehensive, nervous about death? He said, oh, no, Phil, I know I'm in good hands. I thought that was lovely. I know I'm in good hands. And he just smiled. Campbell used to call this being transparent to the transcendent. Just, there's another world. And his other phrase was, I know there's another world, and it's a better one. So he was being playful, but throughout much of his work is this belief, which he shared with many Native people, that there is another world beyond this one. It's a transcendent world. It's an invisible world. Once in a while, poets, Western poets, will apprehend this. Antoine Saint-Exupéry, as in much of his work, he says, the real world is invisible to the eyes, but visible to the heart. And that's what I believe was the overlap between Houston's work and the American Indian work. And one other thing, a note of constant daily celebration. And for this, he gave credit to our great friend Reuben Snake, who we have this in our film, The Peyote Road, which Houston said, Reuben was in conversation with Houston, and he said, Houston, every morning I remind myself of what's sacred in the world, because I get up, if I've been in an all-night meeting, a prayer meeting, a peyote meeting, or if we've been in a sweat lodge all night, or if we've been hiking in a forest, we wait until the sun rises, and then as soon as we see the sun rises, we raise our arms up to the beauty of the world, and we shout out, Aho! And A-H-O, Aho, with an exclamation point next to it, is a great cry for Native peoples of many tribes that Houston and I both encountered, which is, it's an echo of affirmation. To say Aho affirms life. It affirms joy. It affirms the beauty of creation. And in the last couple of years, when I was visiting Houston at Kendra's home now in Berkeley, often we would shake hands as we were leaving, and Houston would just bow down. He would say, Phil, Aho. There was a little code that we had between us. Even in illness, even with death looming over us, we can still affirm life. Thank you very much. So we have a few minutes for questions, if anybody would like some. We have a roaming microphone here.
Well, thank you so much for this. Phil is just getting over a case of pneumonia, so he was nice enough to come here.
My dad used to teach him, don't let him know it hurts. All right, please.
Hi. Carol Carlisle from Ponca City, Oklahoma, grandparents from Pawnee. Just thank you, grandparents. You know, if Houston was here, I would like to ask him, through you and Kendra, how do we claim our own indigenous soul? That seems to be what is missing right now.
How do we claim our indigenous soul? So you're speaking not as Pawnee at the moment. You're speaking as someone living in Berkeley at the moment.
Yeah, because we are so disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have these practices.
Thank you. That's a great, poignant, relevant question. One way is what I write about in here. Anne Houston wrote the introduction to this book, The Art of Pilgrimage. It's been around 20 years now, amazing. 12 different languages or so. I found out in 1997 in a little bullet piece in the New York Times travel section that in 3 years, by the year 2000, travel was going to overcome the armaments industry and the computer industry as the number one business in the world. And it still is, depending on how many wars are going on at once. But you've got a kind of metaphor from the Old Testament. Remember the image of turning swords into plowshares? That's one way to think about travel. Was it Mark Twain? Travel is the death of prejudice. When we premiered The Hero's Journey in Hollywood in 1987, our film on Campbell, the last question of the night was one of these huge overarching questions at the Directors Guild, 1,000 people in the audience. Dr. Campbell, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. Help! What would you recommend to save the world? And he said, it astounded all of us, he said, travel. Like a good Irish storyteller, and the house came down. People were roaring with laughter. I thought he was going to say, read more James Joyce. His wife, Jean Erdman, who is still alive, by the way, 101 years old, Jean thought he was going to say, go back to the Upanishads. We all thought, read, that's what he was going to say, instead travel. In the sense that travel means going out, and then he goes on to say, and it's in my book, The Hero's Journey, travel, but go out and learn people's culture, learn their music, learn their poetry, their literature, learn their religion. And then slowly, if we do this without taking our prejudices with us as we travel, we're traveling like pilgrims, out of respect, out of reverence, out of a sense of inquiry, a sense of curiosity. And that's what I mean, circling back to your question. Now, we begin to slowly stop demonizing the other with a capital O. As long as we don't know anything about anybody else, we're going to demonize them. It's one thing to stop saying, it's one thing to say, well, we should appreciate that religion and that one, but how can you if you don't know anything about it? Or you've never met them. Remember Walter, one of your Pawnee ancestors, is saying, most Americans have never met somebody Native.
Native. I'm trying to say we have Native roots. Instead of other people's nativity, we find our own nativity.
That's what I'm going to. You didn't let me finish here. What I'm saying is determine what your roots are and make a pilgrimage there. That's what I'm circling. And pilgrimage in the ancient sense, and I don't mean pious, I don't mean walking to Santiago de Compostela or walking to Jerusalem with 100 monks chanting Gregorian chant behind you. I mean a journey back to where it all began. That is a pilgrimage, where your people began. Mine, the Cousinots, come from the south of France, 5 minutes from the Lascaux Caves. It meant a tremendous amount for me to go there, where my distant ancestor, Jean-Baptiste Cousinot, left in 1678 with a chisel, because he was a stone cutter, and he made his way all the way to Ottawa and worked on the first buildings in Ottawa to help found the New World. if you are feeling that sense of gap, and most of us do, there is part of your story that's missing. And that's what this notion of pilgrimage is about. Going back to the place where it all began to fill in the missing stories. My wife, Jo, got pregnant with Jack in 1995. I knew our lives were changing. And then I got a letter, similar to the one in Malibu, saying there's going to be a Cousineau family reunion on the shores of Lake Nipissing in Ontario. And we're expecting about 3,000 people. And I thought, whoa, now that will fill in some of the missing gaps, as you're alluding to here. And then there was one beautiful little element and said, some of us are going to get into canoes because our ancestors were voyageurs, which meant getting into canoes and going from Ontario up to the Yukon and back again. 75 miles a day. 75. That's a stroke a minute. So Joe and I went with 19 other cousins, and we followed in the footsteps of our ancestors down the French River, and we arrived in Lake Nipissing, and there were 3,000 relatives waiting for us there. And what did we do for 3 days? What you are, I feel the longing and yearning in your heart. Who are you? Where are you from? Who are you related to? Maybe I know a cousin or an aunt or an uncle. It was one of the most profound moments of my life because what were we doing? To fill in this existential itch, we were telling stories. We were gathering stories because our story is not just us alone. It's very narcissistic to think of us existing like this. Our story is wider. Does that help?
Other questions?
And did it fill in a missing piece?
Everybody looked like my grandson.
Well, that's funny. I went up to Birmingham once. My mother's side of the family, they were French and English. Their surname was actually England. So they named their firstborn son London. He went around life as London, England. My Uncle Lunny, right? So I went up to visit one of my relatives up in Birmingham. And Floss Thornywork. Is that a name for the ages? That's right out of Dickens, right? And she was 90-something years old, and she sounded like Alfred Hitchcock. Because Hitchcock grew up just down the block from her. And I just sat there mesmerized. I just wanted to listen to her. But also, I wrote down the stories, took photos, and so on. And that it helps to know where Reuben, who I've quoted from a few times here, if you don't know where you came from, there's no way in hell you're going to know where you are headed. You can break some patterns, and some of us need to do that. We don't have to be victims of all the patterns that went before us, but we can do something original with our lives.
Other questions?
Yes, please. Thank you for the great question.
I've been musing lately about how modern religion gets so heady and ethereal, and you're setting aside Sunday or churches or temples as something sacred. And the indigenous religions, to me, make it more basic. We had a speaker once from Mexico who said everything about Chicano passion for social justice and change in politics, everything went down to the land because the land was alma y corazón. It was the heart and soul of everything, was the earth. And the indigenous and animated religions remind us that there's something basic. There's something about realizing the land is sacred that is fundamental and taproot of religion. I was wondering if you could speak of that.
Yes. Sacred, yes. That can still be abstract until we actually turn it into a practice. So I've been all around the world. I've filmed all over, not just with our American Indians, but people all over the world. And often a greeting is, kind sir, where are you from? It's right out of Homer's Odyssey. That's how sailors and warriors would ask each other, so where are you from? What is your story? But then the follow-up is, and what is your practice? Not what do you believe, because that goes right back up to the head. What is your practice? And you can be evaluated. I don't mean judge, it's something different, but evaluated on whether or not you are headbound with your spiritual beliefs, your religious beliefs, or you actually practice something. One of the programs in our Global Spirit series that I really recommend is on pilgrimage. The film crew and I, we go to India, so I'm on pilgrimage for a couple of weeks around India. When we come back, we have a Pico Iyer, who is one of Houston's great admirers and wrote beautifully about Houston, and he says something so gorgeous there, which alludes to your question. Travel saves us from a life of abstraction. So we can read, we can go to meetings, but what are we doing? Do we have ritual, ceremony? Do we have community? And that's what our films are about. It's showing people in practice and not just speculating.
And the Hajj, the pilgrimage, teaches you respect for other cultures, sacred places. Then you bring it back home and you realize your own cultural sacred places here at home, that the earth, everything is sacred.
Well, yeah, thank you for adding that, because that's, I have a little bit of that in the last chapter of The Art of Pilgrimage, and in there I like citing Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Buddhist monk, who says, I have to paraphrase, but it's along the lines of, and finally, the glory of pilgrimage is the ability and then the capacity to return home and recognize your own backyard as sacred ground. Now, isn't that beautiful? Because without that, we're forever rhapsodizing about how special India is, or Ireland, as if our only hope, our salvation, is halfway around the world. But the true belief is to come back and have a little smile curling on the edge of our face and looking at our front lawn, our backyard, our neighborhood coffee shop is also sacred ground.
A question here.
One more.
Yeah, you mentioned groups being formed to work with alcoholism on Indian reservations. Back in the 60s, there were groups that were formed in the same way that used peyote to treat alcoholism. And I wondered what happened to those groups. The peyote was suppressed by the government as a narcotic, but were the groups suppressed also?
Well, I was speaking to that a little earlier. It had been made illegal 1991 to 1992, but in 1993 we made a film called The Peyote Road, in which we interviewed Jewish rabbis, Christian priests, monks, I think leaders from 10 or 11 different groups, who said if they can ban American Indian peyote practice, they're coming after us next. And there were records of that. I think there was seven Christian priests were actually sentenced under the peyote precedent for giving wine to minors at Mass. And saying, oh, Christians are hiding behind religion, and they're secretly giving wine to Mass. And several Jewish rabbis were also arrested for bris ceremonies, circumcision ceremonies, using the peyote decision as precedent, which meant when we did this film, religious leaders from all around the world supported us to help give them that practice, which, as Houston says somewhere in the film, may be the oldest known religion. There is evidence of peyote worship going back 10,000 years. And by peyote, American Indians would look at it as the equivalent of Christians taking the host and the chalice of wine at Mass. And what you're taking in a sacred substance. And so, yes, it is still being used to help. I hate using martial metaphors, to combat alcoholism, to deal with, to give an alternative to. You have to be careful about the language here. It is highly effective. In some cases, it's the most effective way to help alcoholic American Indians get off alcohol, because you cannot take peyote if you're drinking. You can't be taking it. You have to get off it. So if you wanted to join that community and every Saturday night be praying to Wakantanka, praying to the Great Spirit, you can't drink anymore. So it's highly, highly effective. And again, if anybody wants to review these films are available. It's called The Red Road to Sobriety. It's our film on alcoholism in Indian country, The Peyote Road, and so on and so on.
We only have time for one more question.
One more.
I want to say thank you so much for your years of good work that is influencing and impacting all of us globally. So thank you. Thank you for your service
and
your ancestors, all 3,000 plus at this juncture. My question is, there a tradition within Native Americans of pilgrimage?
Did you hear the question? Is there a tradition of pilgrimage among American Indians? Yes, but they wouldn't use that question. They wouldn't use that word. They would use a vision quest. So at the age of maturity, when a young boy is recognized as is on the verge of manhood, or a young girl is on the verge of womanhood, they would be asked to go to a sacred, usually a sacred mountain, sometimes a sacred river, but it would be a sacred place, and wait for a vision. Recognition that there is some transcendent force out there who will come maybe as an animal, or perhaps as a voice or a wind, like the wind appearing to Job in the Old Testament. But there will be a sign that there is something other than you and your ego out there in the world. And this force, let's call it a force, will help you become who you need to be. It would be called a vision quest, in the same way that I date the pilgrimage tradition back 60,000 years, because I think Australian Aborigine walkabout is the equivalent of a pilgrimage. Our word comes from the Old Latin, which again, I'm a word hound, so I love these words. Pilgrim comes from per agrum, and what it means is to walk through the fields. Get out of the book. Turn your phone off. I know that's heresy today, but turn the phone off. Turn off the television and put the soles of your feet to the soul of the world, the soul of the earth. It means to walk. And that's what all of the pilgrimages are about, because there's something healing in itself in being focused on one sacred destination. And it's you and your thoughts as you're walking roughly 20 miles a day. That's how we get the word journey, by the way. Journey comes from jour, French for day. And so the journey is the distance you would cover if you're in relatively good health, and you're walking 7 or 8 hours a day, 20 hours. You also get the word canter from pilgrims going to Canterbury. You get the word saunter from pilgrims walking to the Santerre, the Holy Land. So Thoreau has a beautiful essay on walking, the virtues of walking, as a kind of walking meditation. It's at the heart of poetry, of artists, of filmmakers. It's observing. It's looking at the sanctity of the world. It's getting out of the house, taking your shoes off. I like that part of the book. Take your shoes off. Walk on bare earth or grass. The first day when you arrive somewhere, that'll help you feel the soul of the world. Yes, I know some of them, and many of them are inspired by a woman whose name was Peace Pilgrim. Does anybody remember her? I was lecturing somewhere in Southern California when the book came out, and I devoted this whole patch to her, where she had this midlife crisis, and she decided to get rid of all of her belongings. She put on the equivalent of a running suit, and she began walking across the country and then back again. She must have traversed, who knows, a dozen, 20 times, something, and gave interviews everywhere she went about the virtues of walking, paying attention to the world, the sacredness that's around you. And in the end, she was hit by a truck, of all darn things. Terrible. But in this talk that I was giving, a woman came up and bowed to me after the talk. Thank you, thank you, thank you for mentioning Peace Pilgrim. She was so wonderful. I said, why, did you know her? She says, yes, I was her secretary. And now I have all of her journals, and we're gathering all her journals, because she kept journals of all of the people who picked her up along the way, truck drivers and kids going to Fort Lauderdale for spring break and so on. It's really colorful work. So the precedent is out there. I hope some of this has helped you. As the great John Wooden, any basketball fans in the room? UCLA, 10 national NCAA championships. He used to end his talk, I hope I've said something this morning that helps you help somebody else.
Thank you so much, Phil.